this episode of the Information Podcast, we are joined by Duncan Barford, a practitioner of chaos magic and author of Occult Experiments in the Home. In this part of our interview, I talk to Duncan about the nature of chaos magic, the correct usage and application of sigils, and how meditation can aid us in the search of what we want from our lives.
Okay, Duncan, thanks for taking your time today to have a chat with me about all these subjects. I guess the first thing to ask you is, I guess you describe yourself, I've heard you describe yourself anyway, yeah, as a chaos magician. So in a nutshell, really, what does that mean? What is chaos magic as a school of magic?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Martin. I would describe myself as a magician, but I'd also say I've been very surprised to discover that getting into magic has sort of led me into areas that I never expected to get involved in, which sort of more to do with like religion and spirituality, but
right.
But we'll probably sort of come on to that in a bit. But
yeah.
To answer your question about chaos magic and what chaos magic is, chaos magic is a branch of the Western magical tradition that kicked off at the end of the 70s and was particularly big during the 80s. And what we had in magic at that time was basically, you know, Crowley's legacy.
Sure.
And magic that was being done around that time was very sort of like intricate and involved, and you know, you had to have robes and you had to have incense,
yeah,
and incantations, and it all had to be done in Hebrew and all this sort of thing, you know.
Right.
This was the stuff that had been handed down. And chaos magic was basically a reaction against that, where it was a guy called Ray Sherwin and a guy called Pete Carroll, and what they did was they stripped magic back to its bare essentials. And to cut a long story short, what they came up with was that magic basically depends upon two things. The first is belief, that you believe in what you're doing.
Right.
And the second thing is some sort of altered state, which enables you to kind of let go of the believing process as well.
Right, okay, so I've heard that described as a sort of break in the paradigm shift. Is that something that is, I guess that's central to chaos magic, is this idea that you have to change your belief system in order to fit with an alternative reality, almost, one that you want to see manifest in your life.
Yeah, exactly. Say if you were doing a magical working to summon an angel, say, you want to talk to an angel. Well, What do you need to talk to an angel? Does what you need involve like a particular kind of incense, a particular, you know, pronunciation of the Hebrew incantation that's needed? Well, no, chaos magic would say. Basically, what is required is that you believe that angels can and will appear,
right,
and that you will speak to them. That's the most sort of like necessary thing in order to...
And that belief has to be so firm in your psyche,
yeah,
that it somehow taps into this almost, I don't know the word, hack, perhaps, that actually makes that so, if you like, to quote Captain Kirk.
that's the case. And so the second element that's necessary for magic is this thing, this altered state, gnosis.
Right.
And what you would do is you'd introduce some sort of ritual element that would enable you to access some sort of altered state, which is a kind of sort of like, yes, you believe, but you also need to kind of sort of let go in a way in order to allow that experience to come through. So examples of gnosis would include like maybe taking some sort of mind-altering substance, which, you know, would enable you to let go a little bit and have that experience,
sure, yeah,
of the angel appearing or whatever it happens to be. Or sex, orgasm,
yeah,
is another popular one, which was, you know, Crowley's preferred method, of course.
Right, of course.
Which,
yeah,
is just a way of kind of like putting you into an altered state in order to allow the sort of boundaries, the parameters of your experience to shift a little bit.
Yeah, so it's kind of, I heard that the idea is you're meant to somehow tap into your subconscious.
Yeah.
So it's something that forces your subconscious to react in a way.
Yeah.
So it's like a profound experience almost.
Yeah.
Some sort of, so it could be strangulation. It doesn't necessarily be, I guess it would have to be a positive experience though.
Not necessarily.
Right.
Anything that kind of just takes you out of your ordinary self and creates a space whereby, you know, an unusual experience can enter into your awareness.
Breaks the mould.
Yeah. Now, this thing you said about sort of allowing the unconscious to come through, this is something that was very much introduced by Austin Osman Spare.
Oh, okay.
Who was a magician, sort of working at the same time as Crowley, slightly after Crowley's death. And Spare is generally regarded as the kind of, like, you know, grandfather of chaos magic. And he's the guy who invented sigil magic.
Ah.
That was his invention, basically.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess that actually brings us nicely to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is sigil magic.
Yeah.
Which, my understanding of sigil magic, which comes from a book I read years ago called Oven Ready Chaos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I can't remember who wrote that now. Was it Phil Hine or something?
No, I can't remember either.
But it was a chaos magician.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that sigil magic is at the sort of centre of... I mean, certainly I've read that sigil magic is at the centre of a chaos magician's book of spells, which you know, is an awful way to put it, but it's how I think many people would understand it. But sigil magic, my understanding of sigil magic is that it's almost a hack, if you like. It's a way of putting down your intent on paper, firstly, and somehow the universe or the creator or however you want to describe it, somehow there's a reaction, which means that your request to the universe is granted. And this has been described in very different ways by all sorts of different people. But I certainly feel that sigil magic is the best way to describe this, and I understand it when I read it in books about regarding how you have to... It's almost like you have to put out your will in a certain way. So, I mean, first of all, what I'd like to really discuss with you regarding sigil magic is how do you do it?
Yeah.
And why does it work? What's your take on what's actually happening?
Right.
So, I mean, what's the best way to do a sigil?
Right. Whoa, big topic.
Yeah.
right, let's get stuck in. Well, like I said, sigil magic was basically the invention of this guy, Austin Osman Spare. Mm. Now, the classic description of sigil magic that Spare gives us is... what you're doing when you cast a sigil is you're coding your intent. So say, you know, your intent is, I want to become incredibly wealthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you're doing is the sigil is a representation of that intent in a way that's kind of disguised from itself. Yeah.
Right.
Now, the way Spare describes how and why this works is that if we have an intent and we sort of express that intent and then we codify it so that it's disguised from itself, then it sort of like sinks down into the unconscious.
Right.
And becomes sort of like organically part of us, you know, is the way that he kind of describes it. And once it becomes like organically a part of our being, then it's free to kind of realise itself.
Okay.
That's his take on it.
So it's very much kind of going back to the subconscious then. It's a way of, my understanding is it's a way of tapping into that potential that our subconscious has. It's to manifest reality or to somehow shape reality?
Yeah. I mean, let's have a look at... Look, I've got some.
Okay.
I mean, in this little pot, I've got... example sigils. These are just sigils that I've cast for.
So these are
various things.
Absolutely. So these are on pieces of paper. We've got here various symbols that have been written out just with a pen.
Yeah.
And see, when I look at these, I see what look like magical symbols really on paper, and I would have no idea what these represented.
Yeah.
But obviously, because these are your sigils, you know what each one of these represents in terms of intent.
Yeah.
So my understanding is when you have to write one of these, when you sit down with a pen and you say, right, I'm going to do a sigil, I'm going to manifest what I want to happen, so I want to be rich. I've read that the first stage is to just write it down as a sentence on a piece of paper.
Uh-huh.
then there's all sorts of angles in what you do after that.
Yeah.
So you take away repeated letters, for example,
yeah.
And then you use the letters that you're left with to form one of these symbols.
Yeah.
So is that what you've done here?
That's exactly what I've done there, and that's exactly what Spare tells us to do. You know, right. He sort of like gives us these like step-by-step instructions. And I mean, we're looking at these sigils now, and I mean, you looked at them and you said, well, these look to me like magical symbols. And they do, don't they? They've got, they give you a sort of like feeling.
Yeah.
It feels like it means something. It feels like it's doing something a little bit spooky, doesn't it?
Absolutely,
just from
yeah.
the look at it. The other thing is, you said that because these are my sigils, then, you know, I know what they mean.
Mm.
Well, I don't.
Right.
Because I've forgotten
I
what
see.
They mean.
So these are going back a certain amount of time, are they? Or?
Yeah, but I think that's also what Speer was getting at. By sort of expressing our desire as a sigil, it kind of puts it out there. And also gives us license to kind of like forget.
Sure.
Forget about it at the same time. And I think what Speer was getting at was that idea about, you know, you become good at something when you kind of forget that you're doing it.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, if you're learning to play golf or something, you know, you know that you're starting to get good at golf when you don't have to think about it anymore, when it's not conscious what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I think that's the sort of idea that Speer was trying to get at with his idea of sigil magic, that we put our intentions out there, but making a sigil from it gives us a kind of license to sort of forget that we're so sort of bound up in wanting these things. And by kind of letting go of that desire, it gives it a sort of space to kind of realise itself.
Right. So that's interesting, because when I, in the past, when I've tried to do a sigil, the problem I've always had is this idea that you forget what it represents.
Yeah.
Because you do a sigil, and every book I've read on this subject has said the key thing to doing a sigil is once you've done it, once you've written it down on a piece of paper, so you've got your sentence of intent, which, say, for example, mine would be, I want to make money, which, whatever. You've done your little symbol based on the letters that you're left with, made it look sort of as sort of magical as you can. You've got it on a bit of paper, you put it away, but I don't forget about it.
Right.
And
even
if it's 6 months down the line, I see that bit of paper and I go, I know exactly why I did that, and I understand consciously what it is.
Yeah.
And I always remember reading in, I think it was Oven Ready Chaos, it said the key thing with sigil magic is you have to charge your sigil. So I understand that with these, you would have charged them.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the technique that you used, out of interest?
My favourite technique is basically just holding my breath until it becomes really, really uncomfortable.
Right.
Which just sort of puts you into that altered state.
So this is important, because with the sigil, when you've got your sigil written on paper, the idea is that you need this, like, as we were discussing earlier, you need this experience that breaks the mould, if you like, in order for your subconscious to somehow acknowledge the symbol.
Yeah, to just sort of let go of it.
Absolutely. So it can be, as you say, like it can be something, some form of intense experience, like holding your breath.
Yeah.
Or reaching orgasm and just looking at it at the moment of orgasm.
Yeah.
But I've also read, see that's the point where I can get to with sigil magic. I can charge it and I'm confident that it's charged.
Yeah.
I put it away somewhere. But then, I mean, so I can tell here from how you've done it, you keep the sigil. But
yeah, a bit of a no-no, that, isn't it?
Right, because I mean, I've read that you should burn it, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And therefore it's released into the ether, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, any sort of take on what the best method is for this?
Well, let's take this a bit deeper now. Let's get into some, like, good stuff now.
Okay. Let's go for it.
Because, I mean, we've been talking about chaos magic, and we've seen how, like, chaos magic strips magic back to its bare essentials. It's saying that all you need is belief and altering your state of consciousness, yeah. But, I mean, we've been talking about sigil magic, and we've suddenly come up with all these, like, bloody rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Like, you have to make the sigil in a certain way by crossing out letters. And, you have to burn it. You have to forget about it afterwards. Well, it doesn't sound very chaos magic-y, really, does it? Because suddenly all these rules have come from somewhere.
They're conventions, like any other conventions, yeah.
Now, this thing about forgetting it so that it goes into the unconscious and then can realise it itself, that's sort of Speer's idea.
Right.
Now, what is really going on when you do magic, when you cast a sigil. What is it that really happens? Well, I've sort of been thinking about the best way I could sort of like get to grips with this and explain it. And I remember one magical working I did once. My sister was having problems with noisy neighbours. And we did this ritual to sort of, you know, help her situation, because these people were like really kind of antisocial and driving her nuts.
Right.
And we did a ritual. It involved a sigil, but there was other stuff going on as well. But it was basically kind of sigil magic that we were doing. So we cast this sigil. A week later, one of the neighbours moved out.
Wow.
Yeah. My sister looked out the window one morning and this woman was packing her bags and she'd gone. Yeah. Now, what's actually happened there? I mean, obviously, that's a result from the point of view of doing magic. We did a sigil to get rid of these noisy neighbours and a week later, one of them had gone. But you would probably say that it was the case that that would have happened anyway. Yeah. Mm. I mean, that woman, she moved out, so she must have like handed in a notice. She was like packing her stuff,
sure,
all that week.
It
was, yeah.
It must have been at some sort of late stage of the process.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It had already happened, in a sense, probably when we did the ritual.
Right.
But you know, that's still a result from the point of view of what we did. What you get in magic is a synchronicity.
Right.
When you get a result in magic, what you're actually getting is a synchronicity, a meaningful coincidence. That woman was going to move out anyway.
Sure.
But she didn't move out anyway because we did a ritual to make her move out. And it just so happened that us doing that ritual coincided with her moving out.
So what would you say to people that would respond to that by saying that what the sigil may have done is created this parallel reality where she was moving out, but perhaps there was this other reality where she was never going to move out? I mean, is this something that you feel is perhaps misunderstanding the core of what's actually happening with the sigil?
Yeah, it just seems to me a bit overcomplicated looking at it that way. I mean, surely it's the case that, you know, that woman had already decided to go. I mean, we don't have to posit parallel universes or anything like that. But basically what I'm saying is what you get in magic, a magical result, is a synchronicity. Yeah. So say if you cast your sigil for, you know, wealth or whatever, and you get more money, that's a synchronicity. What's happened is a moment of you deciding that you want wealth coincides with an event that actually delivers that wealth.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about synchronicities is that they break down the laws of causality. So we've got the famous story that Jung gave us. Jung, the Swiss psychologist who was the inventor of the term synchronicity. The story that he tells us is that he was in therapy. He got a patient in therapy and he was talking to her, this woman. And she was telling him a dream that she'd had when someone gave her a golden scarab, you know, the Egyptian beetle, the scarab.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone had given her a brooch or something, a scarab made of gold. And she was telling Jung this dream, and Jung was sitting there listening, and he heard this tapping noise on the window. And something made him get up and go to the window. He opened the window, and in flew a golden beetle. Yeah. This is the famous story that he tells us.
Hmm.
That's a synchronicity. Yeah, the woman's had a dream about a golden scarab. There's a tap at the window. Jung gets up, and in flies the nearest thing possible in Switzerland to an actual golden scarab beetle. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a coincidence. That, you know, I mean, that beetle would have been there anyway, but it just so happened that it appears at the moment when this woman is telling her dream about a golden scarab.
I'm right, then that's a very fascinating way of looking at it. And I must say, I mean, I've never thought of sigils in that way, and it certainly does make a lot of sense.
You can think of all acts of magic as actually being attempts to bring about synchronicities.
Right.
All magical activity can be kind of like looked at in a kind of synchronistic way. which is a meaningful coincidence of events.
Sure.
Now, Jung took incidents like this to mean that they show that the universe doesn't only work according to causality, that there's kind of another dimension of happenings in the universe, which is not that like one thing causes another, but that certain things like to happen together.
I see.
Yeah. So what we're doing when we practice magic is we're trying to kind of bring that about. We're trying to make certain things like to happen together, rather than trying to cause something. I mean, me writing something, you know, writing a weird symbol on a piece of paper and holding my breath until it gets unpleasant, you know, what can that cause? All that can cause is for me to feel a bit peculiar, you know, for a couple of minutes. What we're actually trying to do is to kind of make this other way in which the universe operates kick into being, which is making...
Enticing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Making like attract like, making meaningful coincidences happen.
Right, because that brings me to something I wanted to mention regarding, again, something that I've seen certainly online regarding sigil magic, which I'm sure you've heard of, the comic book writer Grant Morrison, for example. And there's a very well-known video that he's put out. Well, he didn't put it out, but it's on the internet. It's a speech he gave at some comic convention in front of hundreds of people.
Yeah.
In sometime in the late 90s, I think. And he talked about sigils. And he said, one of the things that Grant Morrison said is, and Grant Morrison, for those that don't know, he's quite a well-known Scottish comic book. I think he's an artist, so he's worked on projects like the X-Men, Batman, things like that. But he argued that when you walk down the street, all you see are sigils. Yeah. You see the McDonald's M, for example, which is a big sigil. And that's how he describes corporate logos. He says they're all sigils, everyone's at it. Anyone that's in business knows about sigils, but they may not have the same understanding of what they are, and they may not call them sigils, they may call them something else. But in reality, that's actually what they are. They're a sort of symbol of will, if you like.
Yeah.
So my question really is, do you feel that other people casting a sigil can somehow have an effect on your life that would otherwise never have happened? But I guess in a sense you've already answered that by saying that it was only ever going to be as it's going to be. There's no way that people can really change fate.
Mm.
So it's because, I mean, one of what concerns I've always had regarding sigil magic is I don't want there to be a detrimental effect on somebody else.
Yeah.
In order for the universe to shift in a certain way in order for me to get some money
or whatever.
but I guess it, from what you're saying, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that perhaps it's this was only ever going to be the case anyway, regardless of any outcome. The outcome was going to happen.
Yeah.
But you somehow synchronized your life with it. So again, it goes back to a synchronicity. So, I mean, to give you an example, a friend of mine did a sigil.
Yeah.
And it was the usual. It was he wanted to make a load of money quickly.
Yeah.
So I don't know how specific the sigil was, but it was, you know, we're not talking a few years. It was soon. And unfortunately, what happened to him was that he ended up getting money, but in a way that he wouldn't have wanted. In other words, a relative who had some money died and it was passed over. He didn't know about the money. So he was very shocked by this, and he immediately felt that the sigil had actually done something. Then he felt very guilty about it, actually.
Yeah.
So would you say that really he shouldn't be guilty, because arguably that was always going to happen?
Yeah. We're getting into some really interesting areas now, aren't we?
I think, yeah.
What I'd say was, well, one thing you can always do when you do an act of magic is be very clear about your intent.
Right.
So, you know, if you were going to cast a sigil for money, then include that in your intent. Say, you know, I want more money, but without any harm happening to anyone. Or...
Right. So you can be quite specific with how you do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, it all goes, because I think I'm still thinking in terms of rules, which is
right.
There's my kind of problem here. I think, yeah, there's no rules to this, essentially.
Yeah.
So you can sort of almost add a caveat to your sigil and say, I don't want certain things to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And make it as specific as you want. I mean, I've been to rituals where people have, you know, they've got a great big long list. I want this, but without this happening, all this, you know, loads and loads of clauses. And why not? You know, why not? Right. It's just as valid as any other intent. So you can do that as a sort of practical thing if you're using this stuff. But the other thing I'd say is this takes us very deep into, you know, what is actually magic? What is it? Yeah. What is it that's actually going on? Now, we've got lots of definitions of magic floating around. One of the most famous one is Crowley, which is magic is the art of changing conformity with will.
Wow.
Which is the classic one that gets bandied about. It's a good one, but the trouble with Crowley's definition is what he means by will is quite complicated. What Crowley means by will is, you know, what he refers to elsewhere as true will. What Crowley means by will is basically what the universe wants you to be doing. But of course, the common meaning of will is, you know, what you yourself want to be doing.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of misunderstandings around Crowley. Like, you know, his other famous saying, "Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law," which a lot of people interpret to mean we do what you want.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't mean that. Will has a really kind of deep, specific meaning in Crowley, which is basically, you know, realizing the plan that the universe has for you. So it actually means the opposite to that.
That's interesting.
Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law means really connecting with your higher self and, you know, finding your purpose and then doing that. So Crowley's definition of magic, problematic. My colleague, Alan Chapman, who I've work with a lot.
Yeah.
He's got a definition which I think is much better, which is magic is the art of experiencing truth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, as we go about our lives, you know, we sort of get up and we go to work and we're walking around and stuff. There's things going on in material reality. There's, like, you know, walking out of houses and getting onto buses and stuff like that. But also what's going on in our lives at the same time is our minds making meaning out of this stuff that's around us.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, I'd argue that that is what magic actually is. Magic is this process whereby we make meaning out of experience.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what magic is. It's this faculty that sort of makes life meaningful, yeah. Because without meaning, there's nothing.
So it's a way. I guess this brings us nicely onto what I wanted to discuss as a sort of way of a next topic, really. But it's a way of understanding reality.
Yeah.
And coming to terms with certain truths.
Yeah.
And identifying certain truths, sort of.
Yeah.
So it, in a way, it's a way of understanding the nature of reality and perhaps perceiving truth in a way that is perhaps more conscious than just going about your everyday lives being clueless.
I'd even go so far as to say that, like, magic is that thing that makes reality. You know.
Right.
That makes what we experience as real.
Okay.
Brings us back to the stuff in Chaos Magic about how, like, you know, switching your belief affects reality. I mean, I don't know, I have this experience a lot, but I'll be wanting to find something. I've lost something and I want to find it. I don't know, maybe it's a knife, a particular knife or something. And I'm going through the drawer and I'm looking for this knife and I keep seeing it. You know, I think, oh, there it is. Oh, no, it's not. Oh, there it is. No, it's not. And it's as if what's happening is I want to find this thing so much that I start kind of seeing it everywhere. Is it just me who has that, or do you have that?
No, I certainly can relate to that. I think most people certainly. I mean,
yeah,
absolutely.
So it's like your desire, your belief actually affects your perception, yeah? And what you perceive becomes real to you.
Mm.
I mean, that's just a trivial example, but I think that that's when we practice magic, that's what we're doing. Our belief affects our perception, so we want something, so then that affects the way we perceive the world. You know, then it's more likely that we will start to perceive that thing.
Sure.
If we perceive it, then it becomes reality. That can make magic sound as if it's a form of kind of self-delusion, that you're kind of like deluding yourself in order to, you know, have the sort of life that you want. But the mysterious thing about magic is that, no, it goes beyond that. When our belief changes our perception and our changing perception shapes our reality, something does actually change.
Wow.
Something real does happen. So, like, to go back to that example of the ritual where we cast the sigil to get rid of my sister's annoying neighbour, she did actually leave.
Yeah. And that's an undeniable conclusion.
Yeah.
Of that sigil.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And I guess that brings us really to this whole topic of the nature of reality.
Mm.
And in your experience of doing a practitioner of magic and also... the other sort of interest you have, which I understand that you have a fascination with ghosts, for example. I know that in Brighton, which is a town in southern England that we're currently in, which I think is where Aleister Crowley's buried, in fact.
His funeral service is here.
Well, right, okay, so we're in the right place.
Yeah.
But we are sort of constantly in search of the meaning of life, aren't we, as human beings? And there's all these different takes on the nature of reality. And nowadays on the internet, there's all sorts of people. I mean, for example, David Icke's a big one that I've sort of studied for years. He's on this journey of discovery, and it's taken him to all sorts of different people, different subjects. And I've always been attracted by the idea that chaos magic, in a very real sense, does... in a way represent a philosophy regarding the nature of reality itself, which I think you've already alluded to. But in your experience of magic, do you now have any spiritual beliefs that kind of almost elevate beyond the school of chaos magic?
Yeah.
In other words, so I understand that you come from Buddhist roots.
Which I
also do,
right?
And I mean, certainly in my sort of hunt for nature of reality, spiritual truth, I've always been fascinated by this very point that you've just made, which is the idea that we do, in a very real sense, create our own reality, and that in a way is the real truth behind the matter. But I mean, I think it was Robert Anton Wilson, who I understand was another chaos magician, that he said something along the lines of, we all live in a reality tunnel.
Yeah.
So therefore, the idea that there is this nature of reality, which is somehow this great objective truth, is just a foolish way of thinking. And I'm now beginning to wonder if that is the case, and if it's silly to hunt for this objective reality. Is there this objective reality? You know. But I guess my question to you, Duncan, regarding this is, do you feel that you have a greater understanding of spiritualism now after practicing magic for however many years you've been up to this?
Yeah, I do. And it's come as a complete surprise to me that's the case.
Right.
I always used to have a very sort of love-hate relationship with Buddhism. Like, you know, I started off practicing Buddhism and practicing meditation. And it didn't really make much sense to me after a certain point. You know, I just sort of came to the conclusion, it wasn't really working out for me, and I just came to the conclusion that, you know, I'm not sort of a religious person. But really, it's only been since I went back to magic and explored it in detail that Buddhism finally started to make sense to me. But I do think that the chaos magic theory is limited. And I do think that although it's sort of very useful for... beginners getting to grips with like the essentials of magic and you know, getting the magical skills together.
Yeah.
I do think you have to go beyond it.
Sure.
And the reason why it's limited in my view is that by putting the emphasis on belief shifting, on sort of, you know, bending our reality all the time in ways that we want to, so like we want a bit more money, so we cast a sigil to get more money, we want a better job, so we cast a sigil to get a better job, chaos magic never really gets to grips with, you know, where are these sort of like desires coming from? You know, if we can keep like bending our reality to kind of fit our desires all the time and realise them by sort of, you know, altering our perception, altering our reality a little bit, we never really sort of turn back on ourselves and think, hang on a minute, why do I want this stuff?
Yeah.
You know, who wants this stuff?
Yeah. Why do you want it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody's telling you you want it, more than likely. Yeah. The time.
So if you can bend reality, the self that wants this stuff is also a part of that reality. Yeah. So the path of magic, if you keep going and investigate it thoroughly, will eventually lead you to start to wonder about, well, who is it who wants this stuff? And can I mess about with that as well?
Yeah.
You know, why can't I alter that? That's part of reality. Why can't I bend that around? And what's it made of? And who is it? And all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a real fundamental question. And I guess that, as you say, chaos magic, this is where we enter into the world of understanding yourself.
Yeah.
And I mean, because I understand that you practice meditation quite heavily. And this is something that I've started to get into as well. And you certainly do get this sense when you meditate. I mean, I've not done it as deeply as I want to, but you certainly do get this sense that you're suddenly no longer little old you.
No.
And you're suddenly part of this external sense of self self almost becomes an irrelevant word to use.
Yeah.
I understand that obviously with your meditation that you've had very profound experiences meditating, and one of the things that I'd like to ask you is, do you have any kind of key tips regarding meditation? I mean, again, we've talked about sigils and that's all one side of this coin, if you like, but I guess the other flip side to it is understanding really what it is you want in life, and if you have this intent, why do you have it, and what really are you trying to achieve? And I feel that meditation is a good way of homing these questions, getting truth, as you say, understanding truth. So it brings us nicely onto the topic of meditation. And I mean, firstly, is there a particular technique that you use? I understand that there's all these different schools of meditation. You've got the traditional schools, which would say you have to sit cross-legged and all this business. But then you've also got the kind of almost, I don't know if you can call it the modern school of meditation, if you like, which is that meditation is whatever you want it to be. You know, you can just sit in a chair and meditate.
Yeah.
But is there a certain way that you do it that you feel is got a good sort of start of a 10?
Yeah. There seem to be two sorts of meditation when you first start off. Anyway, there's meditation that increases your ability to concentrate and makes you calm. So, like concentrating on the breathing, you know, where you keep bringing your focus back to the breath.
Yeah.
That style of meditation, you know, gets you to be able to focus very sort of well on things, and also sort of makes you very calm and induces lovely states of calm and bliss, and you know, it's all very nice.
Touched on those feelings, just touched though.
It's good stuff, isn't it?
It's good stuff, though.
It's good stuff.
You want to go back for more?
Yeah. But I would recommend that people investigate the second type of meditation, which is called Vipassana meditation or insight meditation, and this is a form of meditation that. It's not so much sort of concentrating on a particular object or anything, but just kind of looking at what reality is.
Right.
Yeah. So one of the techniques for this is just sort of like sitting and becoming aware of experiences in the body. What's it like to have a body? You know, how do I feel right now? How do I know how I feel right now? What is this feeling? What is this sensation? You know, and you just sort of look at that. You know, you can move your focus around. You can sort of like feel what's going on in your legs and your arms. So you're not focusing on one particular thing, but you're bringing your awareness back constantly to reality as it manifests itself to you.
Wow.
Now that's the sort of meditation that suddenly starts to kind of open up things. That's the sort of meditation that gets into the same territory as magic. because you're looking at, well, what is this? You know, what is this? What the hell is this? How does it manifest? You know, so like, you know, we have certain pre-assumptions, you know, that we're kind of a self in here looking out at things that are going on out there. You know, you can start to examine that.
Yeah.
And the more you look at it, the more you examine it, the less that model holds up.
Sure. And I mean, I know exactly what you mean by that, because again, I've only had limited experience of it, but I've reached points where you do suddenly have this unbelievable sense of there being this separation between, as you say, your bodily functions, all this business, and then the actual perception, the sentience, if you like, of you as the meditator, you as the perceiver of these bodily functions. And it is quite an experience.
Yeah.
And certainly that, you know, in the past when I've done this, I've been able to reach moments of clarity, I guess, where it's certainly going back to what we're saying about sigil magic, certainly it helps you understand what it is that you're looking for. Because I do feel that one of the keys here is knowing what it is that you want and why you want it.
Yeah.
You can play around with all this stuff, as I'm sure you can confirm. and sometimes it's not necessarily a good idea, I don't personally think, because I mean, sure, it's good to sort of say you want it, you know, you want money and all this stuff, but do you really want the money?
Yeah.
And what's the money going to bring you? And this is absolutely, where this is where meditation seems to come in.
Yeah. Takes it to that next level, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
My tip for anyone who's practicing meditation, you know, the golden tip is never give up. And never allow yourself to be fooled into thinking that there is something outside your meditation. What I mean by that is, say you're sitting and you feel so horrible, it's unbearable, and you think, well, I've got to stop. Well, no, right. that horribleness is what's happening now, is reality. It's right. to be looked at.
So absolutely. So again, I can totally relate to that, because I think that's something that I am guilty of when I meditate, is this idea that I've got a bit of an ache and I'm not quite ready for this, or I feel like I'll do this later when I'm just a little bit more relaxed and that.
Yeah.
But yeah, the experience is the experience.
It is, yeah. Because the sense of self always comes from this kind of like separating things. It's like, oh no, this is unbearable. And then there's, well, who's saying it's unbearable? Hang on a minute. You know, so there's something unbearable over there and there's me here that can't have the unbearable thing. The sense of self always comes from this sort of like kind of attempt to step back, this attempt to separate things. So if you're practicing meditation, always be aware that whatever comes up is it. You know, you're not missing anything. If you're sitting there and you have an experience that you don't understand, you think, I don't understand what's going on. Well, focus on the fact that you don't understand it.
Yeah.
Whatever you're having is it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's always this assumption that, you know, somehow it is somewhere else, or it's not. No, you're it. Yeah. always.
Yeah, absolutely.